One strange feature of my life is that it's often copied my art, and I think I sang a little bit about Montmartre, the 18th arrondissement, in Tender Pervert, at the end of Tender Pervert. And then I ended up living in Montmartre for 2.5 years, living actually on the Place du Tertre, which is like the most theatrical and touristic part of Montmartre, sort of ludicrous Disneyland of portrait painters. And I think I began to go, as you would if you lived in Disneyland, slightly mad in that place, because Paris seemed like a museum city. It seemed like they could just throw a sheet of glass over the whole city and charge people entrance. I began to yearn a little bit for the real cutting edge of culture, which seemed at that point in the mid-90s to be California and to be the internet, digital culture. Ariel Witzman, who'd been in on the Kihimi Kari sessions, was actually a journalist and a television presenter as well as a musician, and he started this really interesting magazine called Interactive. And I would read that religiously and read Wired magazine and begin to wish I was in America, basically, and have these recurrent dreams about New York. So it was quite serendipitous when this guy, Matt Jacobson, contacted me. He was basically a graphic designer from Detroit. I'd met him in London briefly and taken him out and showed him like the London New Roots acoustic scene and poetry scene and folk scene and stuff that I was sort of fellow traveling with a little bit in the late 80s. And then he decided to start a record label, I think largely to release MoMA's in the States, because there'd never been any domestic releases there. Creation had always stalled and not been able to find the right deal for me there. And this culminated in 96 in me flying to New York and playing my first show in the States, which was at Fez in New York City. And it was a very serious acoustic show, me just doing mostly really old stuff, 80s songs. And by this point, I'd kind of retired in a way. I was doing very well in Japan, making a lot of money with top 10 hit singles with Kihimi Kari, songs like Good Morning World, 1020th Century Chairs, and Lolita Pop Dollhouse. Shibuya K was booming, and my career was booming as a writer for beautiful Japanese women. I mean, The Poison Girlfriend, Mari Hamada, Kihimi Kari, later Emi Nakazawa. This became like a sideline, which became the main line of my career. But I think thanks to Matt Jacobson, I revitalized the MoMA's persona and realized that here was this fantastic place, a continent where they spoke the English language. Quite serendipitous when this guy, Matt Jacobson, contacted me. He was basically a graphic designer from Detroit. I'd met him in London briefly and taken him out and showed him culture and their cultures. I could actually communicate directly, and this was a great thrill. This was a buzz for me. I had a really good show in late 96, and I began coming back regularly year after year to New York. At the same time, I guess I was also forging links with the kind of loungecore scene that was now starting, and I signed with Bungalow Records in Berlin and started doing these tours with Toug, who was a friend of mine from Paris and was writing in a kind of similar style. In fact, I think we both influenced each other, because by the time you get to the analog baroque style, which I came up with in 98 for the Little Red Songbook album, you can hear a kind of minimalism and a modesty and a kind of quirky, amused tone, which comes, I think, quite strongly through in Toug's records too. And in 96, we just put out like a kind of B-sides, rarities, unreleased tracks, demos for girl singers album called 20 Vodka Jellies. And that was just really to introduce the American public to the concept of MoMA's and how MoMA's related specifically to the Shibuya K scene. 97, Shazna and I decided to go separate ways. And I'm the London New Roots acoustic scene and poetry scene and folk scene and stuff that I was sort of fellow traveling with a little bit in the late 80s. And then he decided to start a record label. 97 album Ping Pong is very much a return to classic MoMA's values. It's a kind of back to basics record, because I found that there were people, young groups in Britain, sort of related, I suppose, to Britpop, but also to the loungecore and the Shibuya K scenes, and also to the French pop explosion and the continuing respect for Serge Gainsbourg in Britain. I'd been writing about Gainsbourg in the late 80s, but by the mid-90s, he was a kind of constant reference point for Britpop groups like Pulp and Divine Comedy, and also these young groups like Jack and Orlando, who, to my surprise, when I came back to Britain, kind of asked me to get involved with producing them. I produced also Lila France for Bungalow in 97. And so my own album, Ping Pong, was like a consolidation of just what is the Momus signature, what is the Momus identity, what is the Momus persona. And it was almost like self-parody. It's the, you get the sexual alienation of Don't Stop the Night, recapitulated in a song like The Animal That Desires, which is about the isolation of realizing that you're the only person in the world who thinks sexually at all. And you get this sort of schizoid detachment of, say, the Beast with Three Backs EP, recapitulated in my Pervert Doppelganger. You know, these were almost like the parodies which I felt groups like Jack or Orlando were making of my material. But I thought, well, hey, I can probably parody myself better than they can parody me, so why don't I come back in and reassert my authorship here? That was perhaps the last Momus album, but it was Momus repeating as farce what began as tragedy. It was the last Momus album in a certain kind of style, but for me, the current period, the period that I'm still working in, and a period that I'm kind of very happy with, is this analog Baroque period, which starts in 98. I have my own label by this point within Cherry Red. I'm also releasing and orienting my whole career much more to the States, releasing through Matt Jacobson's Le Grand Magistry label. Just the idea is in my head of songs being things which are pretexts for me to be on stage at Fez on Lafayette Street in New York City, acting out some silly kind of British pantomime for Americans. So I'm kind of very self-consciously, I'm no longer just parodying Momus for British people. I'm now beginning to think, what do Americans think about, you know, British people? So it's like it's a very globalist thing. It's like, as soon as you become self-conscious about how tourists see your local culture, you invent all these kind of spurious traditions, and you exaggerate all the most traditional and eclectic and bizarre elements of your culture. So that's really what I ended up doing with, I suppose, not just British culture and vaudeville and cabaret and all the rest of it, but also with European culture. And then at the same time, I'm being like an ambassador for Japan. So I end up with this totally bizarre kind of Japanese medieval harpsichord 18th century man of reason, sex obsessed character, which is sometimes I give him a name. He's like the Earl of Amiga. He's the guy who presented the electronics in the 18th century shows at Knit Active in 2000 when I eventually moved to New York City. But that, I think, should wait for the next episode.